Welcome back, constant listener, to podcast number 4 of the Far Middle Podcast. And in this episode, we are going to talk about and explore leech-targeted callings beyond the government bureaucrat. Last podcast, we covered government, specifically the federal government, and how much of it or certain aspects of it have become the instrument of the leech. Today, we're going to take a step beyond government and look at some very storied institutions or professions that have proud histories that unfortunately have found themselves targeted by the leech and in many instances have become instruments of the leech. We can start our discussion with a profession that's near and dear to my heart because I'm one myself, which is the legal profession or attorneys. Now, again, this is not a rant on everything anti-legal, anti-attorney. Far from it. The history and the legacy of the legal profession in this country is very impressive. Almost half the signers of the Declaration of Independence and more than half the attendees of the Constitutional Convention were attorneys. So the legal profession has played a crucial role in our country's history from the get-go. But today, when you look at what's going on with the legal profession, it has grown and it has evolved almost lockstep with what we discussed in the prior podcast with the growth of government. So as government has evolved from small and limited, as it was originally intended by the founders, into what is today's massive administrative state, where it permeates everything, the legal profession has evolved alongside with it. And that evolution, from my perspective, for the legal profession has not been a good thing for it and for attorneys or for creators, enablers, and servers. And that evolution matches really what the primary role or focus of the legal profession has been to what it is today. It went from one of facilitating private transactions that would create value, create wealth between and among creators, enablers, and servers. That's what it was historically. So today, the legal profession is more about working for the government. There's also a long history of the legal profession working to preserve individual rights and freedoms. And again, that has evolved today to one, unfortunately, that is maybe more focused on working for the government to sometimes suppress those individual rights and freedoms. And I think the reason you see this correlation between evolution of legal profession and evolution through the growth of government, why that's there, is that the legal profession consists of many intelligent individuals and entities and law firms. And through the years, they have astutely correlated more regulation via government and higher complexity that comes with regulation to more billable hours. They figured out that what is good for government, i.e. more regulation, more complexity, more uncertainty, that helps the legal profession or the law firm with respect to creating a bigger demand for legal assistance and advice, thus more billable hours. It's amazing when you think about the things in life that you would want to accomplish that requires the assistance or the hiring of an attorney or a law firm. You give it a thought, it's almost overwhelming, especially if you're looking to pursue some sort of business or enterprise. But heck, you can't even die today in the United States without the help of an attorney, making sure that your affairs are in order and taking care of your estate. So even death now requires the sanctioning of a law firm or an attorney. And when you take this to the full extent, everyone out there, it could be an individual, a citizen, or individual taxpayer, to a large corporation, a multi-billion dollar corporation, everyone in between and across that spectrum in some way is going to be reliant on lawyers, not just to get things done, to move off of center, but frankly, just to stay where you're at, to stay in compliance with an ever-growing volume of laws and regulations and rules. You see this in some really interesting areas. Some of them might appear to be nuanced at the start, but when you think through it, it sort of comes clear with the bigger picture. One of those areas is what's known as the American Law Institute, which does its restatement of the laws. Now, if you're an attorney, you know what these restatements are because you've basically been raised on them professionally through the years. But the restatements of the law, they historically served as the de facto user manual for the legal profession under certain areas or areas of practice. And the ALI, or American Law Institute, was the entity that basically published these. And historically, the ALI was nonpartisan. But that began to change a number of years ago, probably just over a decade, maybe two decades ago. And you saw it when the ALI published its restatement of the law on torts. And torts is the favorite sort of stomping ground, so to speak, of the plaintiff's bar. So these are the plaintiff's bars that are looking to go out, attorneys looking to go out to sue individuals, sue companies, et cetera, for some form of tort harm on behalf of a plaintiff. Now, you look at what happened with the restatement on the torts back in 2009, I think it was the third restatement. There was almost a seismic shift where it was changing the definition, the theory, and the trending of how different areas of tort law, consumer warranty, contract law, even liability law, were being advocated now under the ALI to be reinterpreted in a light that helps bring more tort lawsuits to bear. And the official reason for this, right, we talked about how the leech is quite adept at masking things through marketing, looking out for your interest when in reality it's looking out for and solving for something very different. The marketing of the effort and the evolution with the restatement of torts was to be able to look out for the little guy, the victim, with respect to consumer warranties and the like. But the reality, when you look at this, is that the ALI was promoting new aspirations from what the law should be so that it would allow for more lawsuits and more litigation, thus more billable hours, work, demand for attorneys and law firms, particularly the plaintiff's bar. So what does that result in? Well, the court system becomes much more congested. The costs for businesses go up. There's more risk for property owners and business owners. And there's going to be higher prices for consumers who eventually are going to pay and cover these higher costs with respect to litigation risk one way or another. It's just like medical malpractice lawsuits. You can go after a doctor or a surgeon, but in the end, if these frivolous lawsuits that don't have a basis for actual harm that was done, if they continue to propagate, that raises the cost to the medical field, and then the medical profession is going to pass that on to the consumer or basically the patient in this instance in some way, shape, or form in the not too distant future. Now, while the ALI is out there changing the theory of things like tort law to create more demand, more lawsuits for the plaintiff's bar to the detriment of creators, enablers, and servers, you've also got at the same time government and specifically entities and agencies within the federal government that are working with the plaintiff's bar to also tip things in favor of the government bureaucrat and the plaintiff attorney, again, to the detriment to the rest of us. A good example that you can find, there's a host of federal agencies that do this, but a good example is with the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. And the Food and Drug Administration, like other agencies, issue warning letters to food and drug companies. And these warning letters, they're non-binding, so it's not official law, and they're not official rules or regulations. And they're presented to basically serve as advice or unofficial guidance, but they're often less than clear. They're quite opaque, typically, or from time to time. And they're very detailed and mired in minutiae. So examples that you would find with these types of warning letters would be when you show the volume of a drink, can you include the ice in the volume or should you deduct the volume of the ice when showing the volume of the drink? Or what types of things do you need to meet to be able to call something low fat or all natural on a food label? The types of things that a consumer wouldn't find material in making its decision or helping with his or her decision on choice. So if the warning letters are unclear, typically, or if they're mired in really detailed technicalities and minutiae, and if they don't really change materially the choice of the consumer, then what's the point? Well, point is that it offers a target-rich environment for the plaintiff's bar to launch all kinds of class action lawsuits on food and drug companies. So these lawsuits typically never make it to trial. That's usually the standard route. They'll settle before trial, but they will settle in the aggregate in multi-millions of dollars worth of settlements. And guess what? Guess where most of those settlements end up going typically? They don't go to the consumer that was harmed under the argument of the plaintiff's lawsuit, but instead they typically go to attorney's fees. What these types of examples show us is that there's a reality out there with respect to our legal system today, and it's not a pretty one. And the reality is that today's legal system, coupled with the regulatory system, it is a fixed game. It's a game that is operating, again, under a bit of a false marketing ruse of something that's there to protect the consumer, protect the harmed party under a tort. But the reality is, it's a system and process that's designed to suck resource or dollars from creators, enablers, and servers, from victims that are bringing suit, from all of the above, taxpayers, et cetera, and to put those resources, to take them from those individuals and entities and put them and place the resources into the pockets of the attorneys, the legal system, in the regulatory state. If you think about it, whether the legal dispute goes to court or not, whether it settles out of court, whether the plaintiff prevails in the lawsuit under these examples, whether the defendant prevails, it really doesn't matter with respect to the outcome. The outcome is one that's picking winners and losers based on the fact that you were fighting, that you had a dispute to begin with, because the winners are the lawyers on both sides, the defense attorney, as well as the plaintiff's attorney. They get billable hours or they've got jobs that are justified by the fight. The bureaucrat, regulator that issues the rules and the guidelines or the warning letters in the instance of the FDA example. The judges and all the court staff that are there and again, sort of grow and propagate based off of fighting and not necessarily who wins or loses. It's the fight that creates the opportunity. And this process continues to play out, and the system is the thing that benefits, not the plaintiff, not the defendant, and certainly not the creators, enablers, or servers that are out there. Now, if you want to see an extreme example of these types of things in action, we can look to a current situation that Chevron, the oil giant, is involved with. I don't know if you've been following this, but Chevron has been in a legal brawl, that's the best way to describe it, for a number of years with an environmental lawsuit and a judgment that was entered against it, a big headline number, multi-billion dollar judgment against it in Ecuador. And Chevron had issues with the underlying lawsuit itself and some ethical issues with respect to the attorney bringing the suit to bear and how the judgment was entered in Ecuador. And it has prevailed in many of those arguments. I think the lead attorney has been disbarred since then. But looking at the magnitude of this over time, cumulatively, Chevron has litigated this incident, this issue in Ecuador. It's litigated it in the United States. It's litigated it in international tribunals in The Hague. Last count, 7 different countries where Chevron has fought this under different legal systems. 36 courts. Think about that. 36 courts, 36 courts, and 100 judges have been involved in this through its history. Chevron saying it's spent about $1 billion and 1.5 million hours of time fighting this lawsuit. Now, that $1 billion and 1.5 million hours, guess who ends up paying for that? Whether or not Chevron wins the suit or loses the suit, we are going to end up paying for that when we go to the gas pump. So this is a great example of how extreme some of these things can be with creators, enablers, and servers, in this instance, a corporation. And then how in the end, even if Chevron wins or Chevron loses, it's irrelevant. The cost, which is massive, is going to be paid by consumers of Chevron's product, which in this case, since it's gasoline, is effectively everyone. What's really interesting about this to me is how this game that we're seeing across the civil and regulatory sides of legal disputes, it was pretty much copied. It's a mirror image of what was going on in the criminal courts and its playbook for decades. I've become recently a big advocate, I guess, of criminal justice reform. I sort of stumbled into it by accident not long ago. I've become pretty passionate about it, particularly here in Western Pennsylvania. That's a subject for an entirely different podcast, which maybe we'll do in the future. But if you look at what happens on the criminal side of our justice system and legal profession, you've got defendants in many instances under criminal law, often from poor backgrounds or from minority backgrounds, that are pleading guilty and foregoing their rights to a jury trial. Now, why do they do that? Well, they're deciding to cop a plea because it would ease the administrative burden for the judges and the courts, and it allows the defense attorney to collect his fees, and the prosecutor, who's ambitious typically, gets to notch another kill on their belt. And why is the defendant doing that? Well, so the system benefits from that, but the defendant or the accused is doing that because they're being hit with the specter of the prosecutor and a judge instituting a much harsher sentence under a jury trial route versus the plea bargain. So that's why you see in many instances over 90% of these types of criminal defendants waive their right to a jury trial. It just is a very similar situation. It was almost copied from what's going on criminally. Now, again, much bigger stakes there, right? We're talking about personal freedoms and individual rights and incarceration. But it's effectively the same type of playbook that has been copied over to the civil side of things and the regulatory legal disputes that we just discussed. And boy, haven't the tables turned on what the legal profession was accused of in the past and what it has become today. You go back to Teddy Roosevelt, who made his sort of name with trust busting, if you read the history books, right, in the early 1900s. And then you get into the 60s and 70s, the 1960s and 1970s with the liberal movement and activism on that front. The legal profession back then, during those times, right, it was accused of being an instrument for business owners to protect their economic interests. So the legal system, from the perspective of academia and government and in the media back in those periods, was being painted as being stacked in favor of wealthy individuals or corporations or Wall Street, capitalism in general. But when you look at what's happened today, a focus and sustained and steady campaign through those decades, it's transformed the legal system. And now lawyers and judges are ones that have shifted the legal system from not protecting commerce, but which was historically perhaps the case, but now it's turned into an instrument of harvesting commerce to feed unproductive bodies. A really interesting evolution through the years of the legal profession. Now, extreme examples of this in play are everywhere, unfortunately. You saw it with tobacco litigation and tobacco class action lawsuits. Last count, the plaintiff's attorneys pocketed $20 billion in fees from tobacco litigation, using smokers and those addicted to smoking as convenient tools to accrue those fees. That doesn't even count the fees that were pocketed by the defense attorneys defending the corporations in this litigation and in this mess. How much of these settlements and judgments and fees in tobacco ended up in the pockets of the real victims, which were those addicted to smoking? I would guess very little. We're seeing the same thing play out with opioids. It's some estimates in circles. It's being shown that the opioid class action mass litigation mess is going to exceed $1 trillion. That's hard to fathom for me, but in many ways, I wouldn't be shocked at all if it does exceed $1 trillion when it's all said and done. You've seen some really storied companies that have brought all kinds of quality of life benefits to society. Johnson & Johnson, where they're under siege via lawsuit for everything from surgical products to medications, baby powder even, bringing mass tort lawsuits. When you look at what's going on with Bayer, when they acquired Monsanto and Roundup, the weed killer, knocked out $30 billion of market value in Bayer, and they're facing tens of thousands of lawsuits and plaintiffs. Asbestos litigation was another one that's been out there for decades, where the asbestos attorneys and the asbestos law firms became extremely rich, some of them billionaires, frankly, while on the other side or the flip side, all kinds of manufacturing and industrial companies that were making honest livings, that were competing in a marketplace, were bled dry. And I would argue again that the victims under the asbestos litigation enjoyed very little of the benefit that the plaintiff's attorneys enjoyed and the defense attorneys defending the corporations enjoyed over those decades. So we spent this time talking about the legal profession and how it is often targeted by the leech because A, it's a really big area that affects wide swaths of our economy, and B, something, again, that I'm passionate about, being an attorney. I think the best way to sum it up is to hate the legal game, not the individual attorney player, myself included. Let's jump over to another area that is very important to all of us and one that I'm also passionate about, and that's education. and the profession of teacher. The profession of teacher can be very wide, covers a wide gamut from a creator, an enabler, a server role, or some combination of those two or three at any given point in time. Just think of the different types of jobs that fall under teacher. You can have everything from an elementary school gym teacher to some university researcher, instructor on faculty in some very technical or nuanced area of the world. And teaching in total, of course, has an enormous societal footprint. Getting it right helps everyone. Not getting it right harms everyone. If you look at the bureaucracy and the regulation that come with the leech mindset that we talked about, how it grows in public education and starts to overwhelm the more talented teachers out there working hard to have meaningful impacts, it's very troubling. This is basically driving the talent out of the profession of teacher, and it leaves students with instructors that, or a system, sometimes both, that leave much to be desired. What's causing a lot of these challenges that we're seeing with good teachers or driving good teachers out of education, and that's impacting student experiences and performance, is typically the combination of school administrators and the administration within school districts, coupled with the public teachers union. Those two things together can often come together in a confluence that creates a series of challenges. Even Franklin Roosevelt, as you heard on an earlier podcast, not one of my favorite presidents, even he, though, had the sort of view of public unions being somewhat of a problem. He understood that collective bargaining and strikes by public unions, including teachers' unions, they shouldn't be tolerated. And the reason they shouldn't be tolerated is that he viewed them, and I think he had a point here, he viewed them as a form of insurrection. Since the strike and the bargaining process itself was in conflict with and would harm the citizenry that the government worker had pledged to serve. So it was a conflict of interest with respect to the nature of a public employee that, again, even Franklin Roosevelt took issue with when it came to public unions. Today, almost 40 states have mandated collective bargaining when you look at public unions. And that creates some really interesting dynamics, particularly with teachers' unions. You look at many school districts in many states, there are many instances where there's not a current teacher that is working across the school district that has ever voted to form the union in the first place. Florida is a great example. It's a booming area of the country, of course. And if you look at its 10 largest school districts, only 1% of teachers were on the job when those districts voted to unionize. New York City, its public school system and its teachers union together, that's another interesting dynamic. Its teachers union in New York City was created in 1960. That means virtually no one out of the 100,000 or so current teachers in the New York City school system and in the union ever voted to create the union. So that's a strange set of circumstances, you would think, that almost results in teachers being in some form of institutionalized conscription. Not just the teachers that are in the union by legacy, but also the districts themselves and, of course, the students and parents who ultimately are the customers. And it's this perpetual public union type of a situation that we find ourselves in, again, whether it's great teachers or students or parents or taxpayers. And I don't want you to interpret my concerns or my views on public unions and teachers' unions as being views on being anti-union in general. I'm far from anti-union. In fact, I'm very much an advocate of private unions. I talked about my support for the building trades on a prior podcast, but my family and my experience in life, my family's been beneficiaries of private unions through the years and through the generations. My father was in a steelworkers union. My grandfathers were both in private unions, railroad and steelworkers. So I've seen the benefits of that. And historically, private unions have played a vital role in improving work conditions for traditional blue-collar workers in particular. And they did it in industries that viewed, frankly, labor as an exploitable workforce and an exploitable commodity. And when you look at that history, and again, I'm a businessman and I work for a public corporation, but the history is what it is. Private unions didn't hatch out of nowhere. They were there because there was a need at the time. And in many instances, like I said, with the building trades, they continue to play a vital role. But public unions are a different type of thing altogether, particularly where public unions are representing a professional class, right, which I consider teachers to be a professional class. That typically spells danger or trouble for professional standards in that class. You want to see high performers being rewarded, outsized rewards, to motivate them, incentivize others to continue to achieve and outperform. And you want to see underperformers basically face the consequences of not living up to expectations, not being all treated the same or high performers being paid the same as poor performers because some contract dictates that that's going to be the case. That's not a good outcome for the good teacher. That's not a good outcome for the student. And that's not a good outcome for the taxpayer. Now, if teachers' unions are focusing on the wrong things, instead of rewarding great teachers and creating consequences for poor professional performance and not putting the customer, meaning the student, front and center on the priority list and making sure that they've got great skills in reading and science and math, then we're going to have massive damage done across a whole host and spectrum of stakeholders. And I think we're seeing some of that today. We're going to talk in a future podcast about student competency levels in science and math and reading and in writing and how poor those are, particularly in big school districts and in urban areas, and damage done to a whole generation of kids with respect to unfulfilled potential. But you also see it with respect to employers. There was a recent study of employers that said on feedback and survey that less than 1% of high schoolers are deemed to be excellent in science, and 2% are deemed excellent in math. Now, those are some embarrassing numbers. There's also been studies that show students that go through 12 years of school in a district with mandatory collective bargaining, they end up on average earning less, having jobs requiring lower skills, and being more likely to be unemployed than students in school districts who didn't have the statutorily mandated collective bargaining. Now, one of the arguments you typically hear from the teachers' unions is that the issues with student competencies not being where they need to be and all these other concerns that we've discussed is it's because of a lack of investment, and you need more investment in education to solve or address these issues. I think that that's a bit of a red herring, and the reason I say that is if you look at where most of the additional quote-unquote investment, when it is provided, within a state or within a school district, when that additional investment is provided, it does not necessarily go to great performing teachers or even hiring additional teachers, as we think of them as teachers instructing in the classroom on math, on science, on reading, those types of subjects. What you see instead is the teachers union focusing on an investment going toward things like non-teaching staff. So growing the roles of dues-paying members, but doing it where they're not your traditional teacher that would be providing instruction or lowering classroom ratios as you might normally hope or expect. And also more and more quote unquote investment going toward pension and retiree healthcare obligations for retirees. And again, I'm all for taking care of retirees, whether they're teachers or any other retiree out there in the form of pension or healthcare benefits. But if more and more of those resources and investment is driven towards that stakeholder, then that means there's less investment that will be available for the teachers in the classroom and the students receiving the instruction, which again are the customers as we should think of them. Now, the influence and power of teachers' unions and what they are focused upon, I think it really came to light during the pandemic. And during the pandemic, we saw the heaviest toll being paid by the demographic that faced the lowest risk from a health perspective, which were kids. Kids over the past two calendar school years, I think, have paid an enormous price that we're just going to begin to understand the extent of it when it comes to their development and future prospects. You saw that a number of different ways. It wasn't just that the schools were shut down for two calendar years in some form. It was also through this issue of student accountability, where in some instances, grades stopped being assigned along with homework that goes with it. Or I've also seen scenarios or heard of scenarios where grades were still being assigned, but basically A's or high scores were being given out on a whim just to sort of create this mirage of things functioning normally. That's not going to be helping the student in any way imaginable down the road. And you also saw this with even teachers' unions having influence way beyond the local districts and administrations that they dealt with. You saw it with the CDC. Center for Disease Control was found, I guess, ultimately under the Freedom of Information Act. It didn't come to light until after that via emails that it was taking advice from one of the largest teachers unions in the land on how you go about school openings. And many of the recommendations that this teachers union had with respect to the reopenings, the CDC adopted it verbatim. Now, you know, a teachers union is a political animal, and it is definitely not a scientific entity. A CDC is supposed to be moving and acting off of the science when it comes to pandemic and reopening or closures. You would hope that it would be sticking to the technical and scientific experts, not a political entity like a teachers union. But nevertheless, that's what we saw. And then you also saw this coming from teachers unions in some instances out there nationally where the goalposts were being moved and the lines were being redrawn. So at first, there was a lot of talk about we don't want our members to return to the classrooms for instruction until cases of the pandemic are dropping within the city or district at hand. But then when all the cases and new incidents started to drop precipitously, then it turned into, well, it's not so much what the incident rate will be. It's instead going to be teachers being vaccinated fully before returning to the classroom. So the standards would change and the goalposts would be moved, so to speak, on even what the conditions would be or prerequisites would be for getting teachers back into the classrooms to do the jobs that they're being paid to do. And then the last thing to consider with teachers unions, and particularly with respect to coming out of pandemic, a lot of frustration out there with great teachers. They want to get back into the classroom and they want the classroom to be filled with their students. They want to get back to doing what they do best, like any great professional would want to do. I've got a lot of friends who are teachers and they are chomping at the bit, wanting to get back into those classrooms and making a difference. And to the extent that their own teachers union is prohibiting them or deterring them from doing that, that's starting to build, I think, some frustration that hopefully might bring about some change on positions and postures. Let's jump over now to the profession of journalism and the media. And boy, this is an area that not only I think has fallen under leech-targeted control over the years, but it's one that really troubles me. I was a big fan of journalism and in media as a kid and as a young adult. It had a really big impact on me. I was a paper deliverer or paper boy. And back in the day, I learned about the world reading the newspaper after I delivered the papers or while I was delivering the papers. So I got very, you know, schooled and up to speed on world politics and national politics and local politics and learned a lot about the world through newspapers and through journalists and media. And back then, you could count on a journalist to focus on the who, what, where, when, and why of the events that they were reporting on. You even saw it with the most esteemed institutions out there when it comes to media. The New York Times had a legendary executive editor, Abe Rosenthal, and he was famous for saying that his primary legacy would be that he, quote, kept the paper straight, end quote. In other words, he wanted to keep it free of political or personal biases and not steering the paper to the left or to the right. Boy, today, you'd be crazy to think that your newspaper of choice is not biased or is not partisan. Definitely not the case. And it's clear. And frankly, the journalists and the editors make no apology about it. They embrace it and they welcome it and they run toward it. And this is important because media and journalism has an outsized influence on our society. Malcolm X, he said it best. He said, quote, the media is the most powerful entity on earth. They've got the power to make the innocent guilty and make the guilty innocent. And that's power, because they control the mind of the masses, end quote. He just summed it up perfectly on why journalism and media and having it objective versus having it biased makes a world of difference. Now, my concerns or my frustration with journalism and the media, I'm not unique. I'm not out there alone. The data in the survey show it. A 2017 study from Pew Research, they found 11% of Republicans, 15% of independents, and 34% of Democrats thought national news organizations were, quote, very trustworthy, end quote. A 2019 Gallup poll found 18% and 23% of Americans had a great deal of or quite a lot of confidence in TV news and newspapers, respectively. Interestingly, in that Gallup poll, the only entity that they polled or asked about that scored lower on the confidence score was Congress. Tells you something right there. So that's a 2017 and 2019 study or surveys from Pew and from Gallup. What do you think it would be in 2021 or heading into 2022? I bet those numbers, if anything, got materially worse. Mistrust of media and lack of confidence in journalism that the American public is expressing, this is something, unfortunately, that was earned by journalism. Journalism brought this upon itself. And you can see that today in many different examples, but you can start with just mainstream American news in general, all of the mainstream outlets, where there's this fake facade that's always put up of a mandate, of unanimous views on how we should be heading and how we should be leaning, and particularly support for the left and everything that the left encompasses, and ignoring, frankly, the other half of the country in terms of what it thinks or what it believes. But you also see it in very nuanced technical areas of reporting. One that I follow and monitor regularly is the environmental arena. And I recently saw that, just to give you an example, from a very well-known and a highly respected newspaper, national, international newspaper, frankly, that was reported on carbon emissions. And the headline was titled, "Carbon Emissions Climb Sharply." So I read that and said, wow, that gets your attention and what's going on there. But again, when you read the details of the story and you looked at the data that were further into the story itself, yes, carbon emissions, they did climb sharply or projected to 2021 versus 2020. That was because we were in a global shutdown via pandemic in 2020. All activity came to a grinding halt. To say that it climbed sharply, carbon emissions climbed sharply, technically true, but a bit misleading, don't you think, once you consider that 2020 was sort of a falsely suppressed low number because of a once-in-a-generational or lifetime shutdown that artificially reduced carbon emissions, and now 2021 is going to obviously increase when reopenings occur. And by the way, the 2021 projected carbon emissions were still lower than what they were in 2019 before the shutdowns. So, you know, you could have just as easily and maybe more accurately chosen a headline of carbon emissions drop significantly 2021 compared to 2019 if you're looking at non-shutdown years. But nevertheless, the whole leaning of that story and thus the conclusion, you can tell what the journalist was striving for with that report. This issue of media and bias in the environmental arena, you also see instances where journalists or media outlets are colluding with and collaborating with other entities like environmental organizations in the arena of the environment that have agendas, biased agendas, hidden agendas, things that they're striving for. And they're working together to create an optic that is very misleading, if not completely incorrect. So taking Western Pennsylvania as an example and air quality, you will see headlines regularly in newspapers and media outlets here that are saying things like, "Pittsburgh's air quality is among the worst in the nation, study says," or "Pittsburgh's region's air pollution is worsening, report says," or "Pittsburgh's air quality gets a failing grade again," right? Those types of headlines that are getting your attention and definitely painting a picture and not a positive one. But yet when you go and look at the data, and I'm talking about EPA data, government reporting data, it shows that over the past 20 years, and certainly over the past 10 years, the region of Western Pennsylvania, the Pittsburgh region itself, has made tremendous strides in air quality. And the rate of improvement in air quality in the Pittsburgh area or Western Pennsylvania is faster or bigger than most big city regions in the country. If you look at Seattle in EPA data and compare it to Pittsburgh, when you look at average 24-hour PM 2.5 peak levels, the Pittsburgh region scores better than Seattle. So again, a data set and the facts showing one set of conclusions and realities versus the image that's painted, that's constructed, that's fabricated by media working closely with entities like environmental organizations that are looking not to report the facts, the who, what, where, when, why, but instead are looking to paint a certain picture or push a certain agenda. That's front and center, not just in the environmental arena, and not just with Western Pennsylvania, but just about everywhere you look these days when it comes to journalism. So as we come down the home stretch here on our Far Middle podcast for this installment, I want to wrap with the topic of career advice to young people and career advice to young people in the age of the leech. Now, many of us have always been asked by younger individuals out there, maybe for the young listeners there, you're looking for or always on the lookout for career advice. And historically, I always fell back on those good old standbys of telling someone, you know, to pick a path that you're passionate about or find something that you're going to make a difference in the world with. I've changed that over the past couple of years, and the leech has really informed my change in that type of career advice to younger people. So the first thing I advise younger people do is not to pursue a profession or a job where it's basically heavily influenced by or completely run by the leech. Now, how do you know whether that's the type of job or not or profession you're pursuing? Well, there's some simple filters. One in particular is to think about whether that endeavor would be working toward ruining or killing or stopping another person's job. So if whatever you're doing is hurting other jobs or going after the destruction of other jobs or industries, that's probably an area that is being heavily influenced by the leech and one you probably, in my opinion, should avoid. Another way of thinking about it is in the words of Adam Carolla, who I'm a big fan of. I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to or see Adam, but if you can, give Adam Carolla a look or a listen whenever you have the opportunity. He's awesome. But he puts it in terms of the sign at the beach. When you go to the beach, there's the sign, and there's a sign of it lists things that you can't do on the beach. He says, you don't want to be the person that's adding to the sign at the beach things that you can't do. If you're stopping people from doing things or making free choice, that's probably not a good endeavor or career path to pursue. The second piece of career advice that I offer up is to have talented individuals pursue industries or careers that are largely unregulated by government. Okay, so that means if it's unregulated by government, you're going to have the opportunity to achieve and develop and pursue things that you wouldn't normally have if it's more heavily regulated. It's another way of saying that find areas or industries that currently the leech is not focused upon. Now, the flip side, don't forget, the leech is constantly looking and monitoring for ways to grow, expand, exert control. So it will ultimately catch up. But if it takes some time for it to notice and catch up, you can do some really great things in these arenas and industries and fields if left unfettered and left to pursue. Okay, constant listener, that's a wrap on this installment of the Far Middle podcast. I will be back at you here in the not too distant future.